The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.
Good afternoon, Doc. How are you going?
Good afternoon, DV, and good afternoon to all our listeners out there. We had a little bit of a late start, but that does not mean we don't have a very interesting show today. So we are going to be talking about something specific, but I mean, anybody can call in, send their WhatsApps, and we'll have a discussion on any of your medical topics.
You know, when it comes to the lunchtime doctor, we have to discuss so many issues. Persons are encouraged to send those WhatsApp and send the information. And with that being said, I want to get right out of it going with you guys and find out exactly how things happen. Somebody messaged me the other day, right? And they said they wanted to understand what causes gas within their bodies.
So that is a very interesting concept. And the thing about gas, it's really just a buildup or an accumulation of, you know, different substances within the body itself. And I mean, gas itself, we usually look at the intestinal gas, or what we call flatulence. And sometimes it's when you eat or you drink something or even talk, you naturally swallow small amounts of air, and that air over time accumulates in your digestive tract. And that's what causes bloating and belching and even that intestinal gas. And of course, the digestive breakdown of food is not something that we can overlook, because as food is digested, you do have bacteria in the gut, especially in the colon, that breaks down undigested carbohydrates. It produces gas as a byproduct of that. And, you know, when you eat certain foods like the beans and the lentils and even things like certain vegetables like cabbage and broccoli, all of these things can lead to it being broken down by this bacteria and, of course, an accumulation of that gas in your digestive tract.
You know, with that being said, how important is it to pass gas? You know, sometimes persons meet and they go out on a date for the first time, there's an embarrassment, you know, they hold it back and they don't let it out, even to burp. How important is it to let that gas escape your body?
So, I mean, I can understand how people would want to, you know, hold back, especially if they are meeting somebody for the new time, for the first time. And, I mean, you could always just excuse yourself. It is important, and it is a normal and an essential part of healthy digestion, because it is going to relieve pressure and discomfort from either your stomach or your intestinal tract, a signal of your gut functioning normally. So it's not something that, I mean, you should be ashamed of. But, I mean, not all gas is equal, you know, Davey. And there are certain instances where you may need to excuse yourself to pass gas. And that is fine. You know, passing gas is a normal part of our gastrointestinal function, and you should pass gas. You do want that excess buildup of air to be able to relieve any sort of symptoms like the bloating or the buildup in the lower gastrointestinal tract as well.
You know, with that being said, we often make joke and fun about it, but the importance of it is significant, and we want to encourage persons. I mean, to excuse yourself is something that we need to do if we need to get ourselves relieved, because I have experienced it, and I'm telling you, it's a very, very painful thing. Moving forward, what about coronary artery disease, and how does it develop over time?
So coronary artery disease is actually something we see so commonly. I mean, I feel like probably 3 out of every 5 patients that we see in the hospital has some form of coronary artery disease. And essentially, the coronary arteries are the blood vessels that supply the heart muscles themselves. And when they become narrowed or they become blocked because of a buildup of plaque, that can lead to coronary artery disease. And that plaque itself is actually made up of,
you know, with that being said, persons often take
substances.
All right, but that,
hello.
Yeah, I'm hearing you. All right, we want to encourage persons to get inside on 623-0106, 623-0106, or you can WhatsApp us at 343-1061. If you have any questions you want to ask the good doctor, please bear in mind that she tries to answer the questions based on the information that you are providing. Outside of that, she doesn't have your medical history, she doesn't hold your medical card, she doesn't know you. So based on the information, give us as much info she can provide information to you that might be able to give you some kind of temporary relief while you visit your medical practitioner. What are the most common symptoms of the cardiovascular disease, and do they differ between men and women?
So this is a very important point to touch on. And I mean, classically, we already know how people do experience heart disease. And the most common symptom that we will get would be something like chest pain or chest discomfort. And we call this angina in the medical world. And for most people, when they are experiencing some form of coronary artery disease, they're going to feel a pressure or a tightness or a squeezing in the chest. And most likely it's after they've done something stressful or they have experienced some sort of emotional stress, like a breakup or some emotional stress at work. And I mean, you know, in addition to that, people do experience the shortness of breath and the fatigue and the dizziness. And even that pain that we notably hear, you know, radiating to the jaw or the neck or the shoulders. And some people will also experience palpitations. They feel like their heart is beating out of their chest, and even nausea in some episodes. But it is important to note that men and women actually do experience different symptoms. So typically the man will experience that chest pain first if they're experiencing a heart attack. But women, we will often get less typical symptoms. So instead of that obvious chest pain, we may feel unexplainably tired. You may just get this rush of fatigue over you. You may even get indigestion, like discomfort or nausea, and sometimes pain in the back or even the jaw.
All right, and I don't mean to cut you, but we have a call on the line, and I want to get in as much callers as we possibly can. All right, they'll call us back. Go ahead. As we continue.
I'm just saying that the symptoms are more subtle in women. And that being said, you know, women are often misdiagnosed or they are overlooked when we're looking at things like coronary artery disease or heart attacks. So it's not mainly a man's disease. And I think it is important for people to know that heart disease is actually the number one killer of women. I mean, it's responsible for more deaths than all the cancers combined. So it is very important that women also take their heart health as serious as we impose on men.
You know, one of the things people tend to think is human beings and we are on the same level. We're on the same playing field, but it's often great to find out that we function in different spheres. Coming up next, while we have the doc on the line, Dalton Brong, they are coming up in a short while to join us inside the Lunchtime Doctor. Again, those questions, if you want to ask it, 343-1061, or you can call me at 623-0106. Outside of that, I did get a message that talks about constipation. How can one get out of it? I guess they're probably asking you how to, you know,
manage constipation. And I mean, we've touched on this several different times, but I think that it's important to reiterate that lifestyle changes and your dietary adjustments, and for some people medication are all essential in improving your bowel movement. So I would say increase your fiber intake. Your goal for fiber has to be about 25 to 35 grams per day. And you can get this from your fruits like your prunes and your apples, or your vegetables like your broccoli and spinach, and of course your whole grains like your oats, and of course beans and lentils as well. And you want to increase that fiber gradually, and of course drink more water to avoid any sort of bloating. And on that note of water, staying hydrated
is most important.
Eight glasses.
Hello, good afternoon. All right, we seem to have lost that call. Again, those numbers are 623-0106, and you can WhatsApp me at 343-1061. As we continue with our conversation this afternoon, Brittany, we move on to our next question that we wanted to ask you. What causes the plaque to build up in the coronary arteries, and what are some of the conditions that we can do to alleviate that pressure? But before you answer that, hello, good afternoon.
Baby boy.
Yeah, talk to me.
My doctor make me feel so good concerning health. Any information on health, I happy. So, doc, talking about gas. Can gas go in your heart and in your head? Because people have headaches, they say gas. I do believe so. And which vein is attached? Is it the same blood vein? If it's not in your head, is it the same blood vein the gas takes to go there? And do you, can you get also gas in the middle of your chest? And people might think it's heart attack. Thanks a lot, doc. We're listening.
All right, thank you very much, Fast Track, for your question this afternoon.
Right, so gas is something that involves our digestive system alone. So no, it does not go to the heart or to the head. But there are certain types of gas buildup that can feel or cause symptoms that feel like they are coming from the heart or the head. So when people have trapped gas in the stomach, or in the upper gastrointestinal tract from, say, bloating or indigestion, that can actually push against your diaphragm, and that is what mimics like chest pain and heart palpitations or discomfort in the chest. But that is not gas in the heart. That is just your, you know, that gas in the digestive tract pushing against the cardiovascular system. And gas in the brain, quote-unquote, gas does not enter the brain, but bloating or poor digestion or imbalances in your gut can affect what we call the gut-brain axis, and that can lead to the headaches and the brain fog and the lightheadedness. So all of these things are indirect effects caused by inflammation or stress hormones or gut-brain signaling, and not actually gas in your head. So gas just follows the digestive tract. It does not go in your blood vessels. It does not go in any other system in the body.
You know, that's a very interesting phenomenon there, because persons like to say, I have gas in your head, that's why you're getting that headache. And I remember the last time I sat with you, we went through a wealth of information dealing with headaches and the different types of headaches. Hello, good afternoon. Welcome.
Davey.
Tell me.
Thanks for the intro, Doc. This is Arima, boy, not Morales.
Sorry about that.
All right,
cool. Thank you very much. And, I mean, when we talk about gas and the importance of it, we want to encourage persons. I mean, Doc, in all fairness, Dr. Brittany Dean, persons tend to feel a sense of embarrassment when these things happen. These natural things of life happens to them. And in some instances, we are encouraging, if you have to excuse yourself, but to keep it in. It chokes you and it stifles you. When it comes to the coronary artery diseases, who's most at risk when it comes to those things for developing the CAD diseases? Is this hereditary? Is this something that you can inherit from your parents?
So this is very important. And we do see the normal. So when we talk about coronary artery disease, remember one of the long-term complications is a heart attack, because if you block up the arteries, you're not getting any blood to the heart, so you're going to get a heart attack. So we look at what are the risk factors for a heart attack, what are the risk factors for coronary artery disease. And the things that we always hear, the high blood pressure, the high cholesterol, the diabetes, the smoking, obesity, physical inactivity, chronic stress, and yes, age does play a factor. And this is a very interesting point here. Men over 45 are actually more at risk, but women over 55, their risk now becomes equal to that of a man, and that's because they've gone through menopause, because we have estrogen as young women, and that estrogen is very much cardioprotective. So before the age of menopause, our risk for heart disease is actually lower than that of a man's, but postmenopause, the risk for a woman actually equals that of a man. So that's just an important and interesting point. And of course, like I said, men are typically affected at a younger age. But on that note of hereditary, genetics do play a significant role. So if you do have a first-degree relative, say your mom or dad or sibling, developed heart disease at an early age, your own risk is significantly higher. But this is where it is very important. Genetics is not destiny. Lifestyle changes can greatly reduce your risk, even if you have a family history of coronary artery disease. And we tend to think it runs in my family, so I can't do anything about it. But that is not true. You can absolutely take control of your heart health through early screening protocols and, of course, creating those proactive changes in your life.
You know, one of the things people say, I don't smoke, I don't drink, I have a balanced diet, but yet still, I had a mild heart attack. So what happens in instances where persons are getting those CADs when they perceive or seem to be living a very healthy, active, balanced lifestyle?
Right. So the factors that you listed, no smoking, no drinking, they eat well, you know, they may be working out every day. All of these things are very good, but we have to also realize that these are not the only factors that contribute to inflammation in the body. And inflammation is something that contributes to that plaque buildup in the arteries. We have to look at other factors like somebody's emotional stress or some sort of trigger, for example, an autoimmune disease that can be triggering inflammation and these blood vessels having this plaque buildup. So a lot of these things are not in isolation. And I mean, very rarely you will find somebody actually suffering a heart attack when everything is on point. Then we have to look at the psychosocial factors, which is like, what is their home life like? What are the emotional triggers? How is their stress response? Are they overstressed? Do they have workplace stress? There are many different things that can cause inflammation in the body itself. So we have to look at the holistic picture of a patient.
All right. We have a texter coming in all the way from New Jersey, and they're saying that they're on vacation. They said their stomach makes a lot of loud sounds, like the gurgling of a sink, you know, when the water goes down. It says sometimes they have eaten, so they're not really hungry, but it's very, very loud that other persons also hear their stomachs. They're asking you, please, what can they do?
So there are several reasons why this may be occurring, and the person said that they eat, so it's not really hunger. But it could also be that digestion is in progress. So after eating, your intestines, they actively break down food, and that movement of that food or that liquid or that gas, it can actually cause audible sounds in a lot of people. And eat certain foods as well, so the cabbage and the broccoli, all of these things, it produces more creases your gut sound. So it's not really something that we see as worrisome, unless you start to get a lot of pain and cramping and of course other GI symptoms like diarrhea, constipation or nausea and vomiting. But really and truly, what I would suggest for this person is that you eat slowly and you eat mindfully. You want to chew your food thoroughly to aid in digestion. You want to avoid gulping any sort of foods or drinks because that reduces the amount of air that you're swallowing with the food. And of course, do not talk while you're chewing. Again, that minimizes the amount of air that you're swallowing. And maybe try to avoid any sort of gas-producing foods like the beans or the cabbage or the carbonated drinks and dairy, especially if you are lactose intolerant. And regulate your meal schedules as well. Don't skip the meals. An empty stomach is going to trigger stronger contractions in your muscles and create louder noises.
Thank you very much, Dr. Dean. It's now 12:30 in the nation's capital. We've got to switch gears a little bit as we get set to bring in Dalton Brong and Associates, the optometrist. It's all about Myopia Awareness Week. We have a guest, Andrea Carter and Mrs. Jaya Lakshmi Tilak. They are both optometrists, and they're here to join us as well. Dr. Dean. Brittany?
Yes. Hello. Yes, I'm waiting for the optometrist to come on so we can have a good conversation.
They are on already.
Yes.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi, yes, we're here.
Yes. So we are talking about Myopia Awareness Week today. So can you share a little bit with the listeners what exactly is myopia and what is Myopia Awareness Week?
So Myopia Management Month is basically a really great initiative to be able to raise the awareness about the importance of managing nearsightedness, also known as myopia, especially among school-age children and young adults. So basically, myopia or nearsightedness is becoming more and more prevalent, and we are seeing this within our practice environment on a daily basis, especially since the world have taken a bit of a turn, especially in technological age now, introduced after COVID. So, you know, if we had 5 patients show up previously before COVID, we would have seen maybe 2 of those 5 kids needing glasses. But now it would have increased to all 5 of those children having glasses. So it's very, very crucial to educate the public, be it whether it's the grandparents, your parents, or babysitters and so, about what is really myopia and what are the signs that they need to look out for, especially with these very young school-age children.
Great. And are there any causes of myopia that you can share with us?
Yes, they are. So basically, it could be due to genetics. For example, if they are one parent or two parents, it actually determines the percentage of myopia inheritance that they can actually get. So, for example, in some studies would have shown that if one parent was myopic, then they probably would have had at least 2 times likelihood of developing the myopia. Versus if both parents are, then, you know, they may have at least 4 to 5 times increased prevalence of getting that myopia. So parents who are aware that, you know, they are unable to see things at distance, or that, you know, they are indeed myopic, where, you know, seeing things at near seems to be fine, but distantly it's a bit compromised, then do have your kids come in to the optometrist and have their eyes checked out. Apart from genetics, we have a lot of environmental factors. So like I just would have mentioned, a lot of near work can actually encourage a child to become very short-sighted. So prolonged engagement in activities that require close-up focusing, such as reading, usage of electronic devices, and even studying, is associated with a higher risk of myopia. Ms. Carter, you want to add to that list?
Oh, all right. So also, less time outdoors. So in this day and age, you know, the kids are really on the devices, so the phone, tablets, and all those things. So they barely spend any time outdoors at all. So this lack of exposure to sunlight as well would also cause them to become short-sighted or become myopic as well.
So even their lighting conditions, so like, for example, if they have low levels of natural light indoors, that will also contribute to myopia development. I know a lot of the time parents, grandparents, you know, the easiest thing to do for their kids when they come home from school is just to give them a device, or maybe on weekends to leave them unattended for some periods of time. But there are some parental controls, and maybe they can put things into place where they limit that device time. And that's maybe some options that we could probably discuss at another session. But all of these things do contribute to the child becoming more and more short-sighted.
Well, even if they just really need a break, sometimes maybe the television might be a little bit of a better option, because that's further from their eyes as opposed to having the phone or the tablet, which is directly in front of them and closer, which induces the myopia.
Thank you. And can you explain what are exactly the risk factors associated with becoming myopic?
Right. So the risk factors would be about the same thing, which would be excessive near work. So engaging in activities that require a lot of near focusing. So same thing with the phone or the tablet, all those things would be a huge risk factor for developing myopia. Especially for kids at this impressionable age, their eyes are still growing and it doesn't stabilize until about the age between 18 to 21. So at this age, it's the point where we really want to just take action to really try and slow the progression of that myopia. Other risk factors would be, like I said, lack of outdoor activities. So they're not outside there getting the sunlight that they require to try and slow the progression of that myopia. As well as Mr. Locke would have mentioned, the genetic predisposition of that, where if the parents have it, then there's a very high chance that the kids will get it as well.
Thank you. And how does myopia really impact the vision and the overall health of a child?
So just to kind of understand in terms of what happens with myopia, that's basically a refractive error where the light rays actually focus in front of the retina instead of on the retina, and that results in blurred vision. So how it actually happens, you know, the child would start seeing things very blurred. You know, they are unable to see the board at school. You know, they might be a little bit quicker with reading versus if they have to do some sort of work at school, they might want to copy from their friends' books or things like that. You know, they may walk up very close to the television. They might be rubbing their eyes. You know, they might be complaining of a lot of different symptoms.
Squinting
as well as a very, very common one. And, you know, sometimes parents will come in and they'll be like, you know, but my child have really good eyesight. You know, the teacher just give me a form or tell me to bring my child in for an eye test. And when they actually come in and they sit on the chair and then we put up the letters for them to read,
they can't even read the biggest letter.
Yeah, sometimes they can't even read the largest letter on the screen. And, you know, then the parents will turn to the child and be like, I never knew that you couldn't see. So imagine walking around and you are unable to see things. And imagine that that child is thinking that that is really their new, that is their normal.
Yeah.
But then when they get these glasses now, then everything comes into focus. Everything, colors look brighter, people looked much more clearer and more crisper, details could be seen. So it actually impacts in terms of their visual impairment. Now they could actually be at risk because when you're myopic, you know, as Ms. Carter would have mentioned, is that the child is predisposed to the length of that eyeball is going to grow longer and longer. That means to say that the retina is going to get thinner and thinner at the back of the eye. So that leaves them at risk of developing things like retinal detachments at an earlier age. So, you know, so for example, if your child is telling you, I'm seeing a lot of things floating around in my vision or flashes of light, then that's a medical emergency. Then bring the child in to come and see us, you know. They could even be at a higher risk of developing glaucoma. So glaucoma not only affects the older folks, but it also could affect the younger population as well. And that's something, it's called juvenile glaucoma. We do see a couple of cases of this if they have a family history of it. They could also develop cataracts as well. That's where the natural lens of the eye can become clouded and causing visual problems. So there are a couple of different things that, you know, it does impact the vision and that actual overall health of the child and well-being. And, you know, you don't want your child to sit in a class and, you know, they're crying or they don't want to go to school or they're complaining of headaches or, you know, we want to increase their quality of life.
Yeah.
And that's what coming to have their eyes tested, that's what it's going to do for them.
I think it's also really good to just be present and pay attention. I know some parents might just be busy, they're working and all those things. But kids, I think they just don't know how to communicate sometimes. Okay, mommy, I'm not seeing, or those things. We really have to look out for the signs as well, such as going close to the TV, the squinting, and all those signs that Mr. Locke would have mentioned before.
That's great, and I absolutely agree. But how exactly does that myopia develop and progress over time, especially going through childhood to adolescence?
So So myopia usually develops during childhood, typically between the ages of 6 and 12. So during this time, the eyeball will get a bit longer, causing the light rays to focus in front of the retina instead of directly on it. So genetics and environmental factors will play a crucial role in this process. It also tends to progress during adolescence. Now, the rate of this progression will vary among different individuals, and the factors that would play a role would be hormonal changes, as we said, increased or excessive near work, less time outdoors, and all those things as well. There's also cases where if there's extremely high myopia, as Priscilla would have mentioned, there's a lot more risk factors in terms of getting a retinal detachment, glaucoma, and all sorts of vision-threatening complications with that. So it's very, very, very important for us to try and take action, for us to make the public aware about myopia and how we can move forward in managing the problem.
And how important is it to have that myopia detected?
It's actually really important. It's extremely, extremely important. And we see it on a daily basis with patients that walk through our door. We actually have an increased percentage of younger children coming in, and it's starting from the age of probably 3 years in the start-up.
Yeah,
all the way going up. So early detection of myopia through routine eye examinations is very important for us to actually be able to manage it. Because, like, for example, as the child gets older and older, we have a critical period, a critical window, and that is up to, like, age 9. So, for example, like, let's just say if we have a 3-year-old and they have, like, maybe 4 diopters of myopia or short-sightedness, and then they come back at age 5 or age 6 or something like that, and they have a lower amount or grander amount, then it kind of involves us, the optometrists, we are able to understand and try to see to take the necessary steps available to try to manage that short-sightedness, how much we can try to slow down the progression of the myopia. Unfortunately, we cannot stop it and we cannot reverse it, but we can slow it down, and that's by taking the necessary steps. So, like, for example, you know, you send your kids outside for at least 2 hours a day. They need that sunlight. That sunlight is crucial for the development of the eye. You limit their screen time. So what I like to tell parents is, yes, they might have a maximum of 1 hour to 2 hours, but you give them like a 30 minutes or 20 minutes, then you send them outside, or, you know, you let them look at some television. So it's not all near work or not all device work only, but, you know, they need to experience that life outside or within a room space. So it's very, very important for kids to have regular eye examinations. Usually, if in the event that, depending on how quickly that child progresses with the short-sightedness, we as the other, you know, we want to see them back within 6 months or 3 months or within 12 months. So it's important and imperative that parents bring their kids in to have their eyes tested.
And on that note of children having their eyes tested, what age should children start having those regular eye exams?
At least, I would say at least 3 years old, when they can detect like letters or shapes and so. At Dalton Brown, we have a lot of different ways of interacting with the child and testing them. So it all depends, but I would say about 3 years and above.
Okay, and back to myopia, how do you and how do the parents manage and control that myopia progression in a child?
So managing and controlling the myopia progression involves a combination of lifestyle modifications, optical interventions, and in some cases, pharmacological interventions. So as Mr. Locke would have mentioned, spending more time outdoors. So try to encourage the kids and the adolescents to spend more time outdoors, especially during daylight hours, right? the sunlight is very important as it can help slow down myopia progression and even reduce its risks by stimulating the release of dopamine in the retina, which helps regulate the eye growth. Because that's the goal of it. We want to try to help regulate or slow down the eye growth, because as the eyeball grows longer, then that means the prescription or the myopia gets worse. We also want to reduce the screen time, as she would have mentioned, so at least 2 hours per day, with breaks in between. Other optical interventions would be things such as multifocal contact lenses, autokeratology contact lenses, which are like a hard contact lens, as well as prescription eyeglasses with specific lens designs. All of these, their mechanism of action is really by controlling the peripheral defocus and modifying pattern of the light entering the eyes, which again helps regulate that eye growth. And then the pharmacological interventions would be low doses of atropine eye drops. This will be done by the ophthalmologist, where how the medication works, it dilates the pupil and temporarily paralyzes the accommodation, and it has shown promising results in slowing the progression of the myopia.
So just to add to what Ms. Carter would have mentioned, is that all of these options are available at Dalton Brown. So we do specialize pediatric testings on these children, and we do have these lenses and contact lenses available. So for example, we have myoless lenses available as one of the spectacle lens designs to be able to help create that defocus that Ms. Carter would have mentioned, to kind of control how quickly that length of the eyeball is working. So we do have all of those options here.
Okay, and just for any parents that may be listening, if myopia is left untreated and left to progress, what are the complications that these children may face later on in life?
Well, basically, they're going to have reduced vision, you know, that a type of vision, like sometimes, for example, if left unattended for quite a period of time, you know, as opposed to the child wearing glasses at an earlier age and getting 20/20 vision, sometimes when these children do come in later on, they're unable to achieve that 20/20 vision. You know, sometimes bringing them to that point is a little bit difficult, but we try our very best with them. You know, that development of that eye, it supersedes as time goes on. You know, they get higher risk of developing ocular conditions in the eye, as we would have mentioned previously. So you don't want to leave it unattended, because then the child is going to become very frustrated. They're going to be affected in terms of their quality of life, their education. Is, you know, the world has so much beautiful things to see. And, you know, your child, I mean, like some parents, they come in and they become quite emotional when they see that, you know, their children could not see, you know. So it's very life-changing. And I would definitely recommend that parents, grandparents, guardians, or whoever may have kids or grandkids, to bring these children in. And, you know, talk to the teacher, because they are the point of contact at school. They are the caregivers at the end of the day. And sometimes they are the ones who do send these children to come and have their eyes tested, because mommy and daddy probably working overtime, or granny or grandpa just giving them the devices, and they're not really understanding why they are holding these devices very close to the face. Or, you know, why are they going close to the television? Or why are they crying a lot of the time or squinting? So these are the signs that you want to look out for.
Also, if they come at a very late stage, as you would have mentioned, sometimes they're not even able to fully adapt to the prescription, which makes it very difficult on their end as well. Or sometimes their vision, as Ms. Sulak would have mentioned, is not even fully corrected to that 20/20. Their eyes would have just become so accustomed or adapted to that better vision that they could have seen before, so it's still even very reduced with the correction.
We have seen a couple instances where, like, if they are not getting corrected for glasses, like sometimes the signal of one of the eye tends to, it might either turn out or things like that.
So that's where you get the eye turns and whatnot as well, because you're not getting that correction to stimulate that proper vision in the eye. So it becomes weak, and sometimes you get those eye turns as well.
Thank you guys for giving us a very informative and enlightening topic to think about, especially for all the parents and even the teachers out there. Is there anything else that you would like the listeners to know as it pertains to Myopia Awareness Week?
Just the regular testing, look out for the signs. The signs are very important because, as we said, sometimes kids are just not able to communicate what it is they're actually experiencing. So just really look out for the signs and then book the exam and we'll take over from there.
It's like a simple thing, like, you know, if you have kids and they're missing letters or they're mixing up letters from a B to a D or little things like that, you know, you could bring them in and just we will be able to like take a look and see what's going on. Maybe colors as well. We do color vision testing here on all our pediatric patients, especially the boys, that is very, very important to be able to detect whether they have that color vision or not. So it's a lot of things to bear in mind, and we definitely urge everyone to contact us. You can give us a call at 667-3115 or 299-3115, or just come and visit us at our office at corner of Queen and Susanna Street in Arima.
Also, one more thing. So, like, those parents who think their kids have problems, learning or they're writing stuff wrong from the board and whatnot, and they come in and they can't respond or we're not getting much responses from them, we would do a different type of test to get a proper prescription for them. And sometimes, even if they actually don't have a prescription, then we pick up is actually something else wrong with the child. So maybe they have like some sort of issues.
Disability. Yeah. Sometimes they may be dyslexic or things like that. We can determine all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Right, thank you guys for enlightening us.
Thank you so much, guys. Have yourself a great day. All right. So as we have a few minutes to continue, to conclude the Lunchtime Doctor this afternoon, we continue our discussions here with Dr. Brittany Dean. Of course, you can send those questions to me at 343-1061. Dean, we have a question here. Very interesting and educational program. I am enjoying it. Another one is asking if you can clarify once again, what is myopia?
Do we still have the...
I don't know.
Yes.
Okay, great.
Right, so they wanted to ask you, what is myopia?
Sure. So myopia is a refractive eye condition where you are able to see things clearly close up, but in the distance, it's very blurry. And that's really due to the length of the eyeball, where the refractive rays focus in front of the retina instead of directly on it. So basically, in short terms, it's blurry distance vision, but close up is clear.
Okay. And how does one, again, finally counteract this?
So there are different options. We could do tested glasses or even contact lenses. It really depends on how extensive the condition is as well to know which treatment option or management option would work best for them.
I'm glad to have you on the line, because one of the questions I wanted to ask was, when it comes to contact lenses, is that a one and done, or is it something that has to be changed over a period of time?
Yes, it is something that, well, it depends. So we would test regularly, and depending on the changes, we will know if it's stable or if we need to update the prescription on the contact lenses.
Yeah, but then also differs as well on the patients and what type of needs that they need these contact lenses for. So whether they need it for maybe if they have advanced keratoconus or things like that, or if they just need it because they want to go out on social occasions. So there are different modalities or different types of contact lenses that could be prescribed for them. So like, for example, whether it's a daily lens or if it's a bi-weekly lens or a monthly lens, it all based on the needs of the patient as well as the prescription when we do the specialized testing on the patients.
So contact lenses is something that has changed every day, every fortnight, every month. I was told recently it's every month you must buy a fresh set.
Well, it depends on the type that they would have prescribed for you. So if it's that you're changing it every month, then that means it's a monthly lens that you got. if you have a daily disposable, like let's say you're putting them on to go out to a party or whatnot, once you open the package and you put it on, after that, when you're taking it off, you're just throwing it away. So that's one, that's a daily use. And then the bi-weekly is, let's say you open it today. It doesn't matter how many times you use it. If you open it today, 2 weeks from today, it will expire. So it really depends on the type that they would have prescribed for you.
All right, and moving forward, very quickly, we have about 3 minutes or less to really wrap up these questions as we have you on the line. One message came in as to how often should one check their eyes?
It all depends. So preferably every year or to every 2 years. Please don't extend that. Like for example, in diabetic patients, patients who have like cataracts in the eyes or who have glaucoma in the eyes, we'd want to see them on a yearly basis. As opposed to healthy individuals, everybody, like, they are fine, then it would be every 2 years.
Sometimes for the kids as well, depending on the type of prescription they have, we may do every 6 months as well to monitor any increases or changes in that prescription.
All right. With that being said, I want to thank you guys, Dalton Brown, optometrist, for being a part of the show, The Lunchtime Doctor, today. It has been a pleasure chatting with you all. And we do wish you guys a very safe and productive day ahead. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye-bye, guys.
Bye.
Dr. Dean, in
yes,
conclusion, please. This, you know, it's always a pleasure when you and I bunks together. Of course, we want to thank all those listening to us on our sister station, Freedom 106.5. I'm in Sangeet Studios at the moment, guys. In case you're wondering, that's why I'm saying sister. But it's Freedom, Sangeet, and of course, Sky 99.5 FM. We are just about 2 minutes out from 1 o'clock. Dr. Dean, in wrapping up this afternoon, how can one take care of their health in general to ensure that they keep away diseases such as the common cold and other, you know, diseases that may harm our bodies?
So I look at health holistically. So it's not just about things that happen to us physically. Everything is intertwined. So you have to look at what are you doing on a daily basis that is going to contribute towards your long-term health. And these things need to be consistent. So healthy eating. So we always talk about the whole foods, you know, are limiting the process and the refined carbohydrates and the refined foods, and sticking to what we know is healthy, like our fruits, our vegetables, everything in balance. And of course, exercising. Having a sedentary lifestyle actually puts you at risk for a lot of different diseases. So even if you are eating very healthy, but you are not moving your body, you're still putting yourself at risk. And of course, our sleep is also very important. When we sleep, that is how our body regenerates and rejuvenates itself. So getting that proper 7 to 8 hours of sleep per night is going to be crucial. And stress management, we tend to neglect stress as well. And this is very important because stress really raises our cortisol and also causes inflammation throughout the body. And we have seen that even if you are doing everything correct, but you have high amounts of stress, you can still put yourself at risk for many different diseases.
All right. Thank you so much, Doc. We are out of time, and we do appreciate you for being with us every Monday, Wednesday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. So catch you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow.
All right, have a great one.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.